Hello and welcome to We're Watching What? Or in the case of today, we're interviewing who? I'm your host Dana, or the DHK as I'm known, and I'm very excited to be joined by award-winning producer and showrunner Ben Roy. He has a new docuseries on Netflix. It is called Our Living World, and it's a new nature docuseries exploring the macro and micro connections between our entire planet. It is narrated by Academy Award winner Cate Blanchett, aka my favorite Elven Queen. It's 4 episodes. They're all already streaming on Netflix. We do reference a couple of things that happen in the series, but you can definitely listen to this without having seen it, although I of course encourage you to watch the show. And now, without further ado, here's we're interviewing who? Logistically, which do you think was the most challenging set of creatures to capture?
Wow. Do you know what? The cicadas were tricky because they're predictable in that they emerge once every 17 years and you know that they're going to come out in spring. But actually, when you drill down into when they are actually going to appear, you need the soil temperature to be a constant over whatever it is, 17 degrees C at six inches below the surface for 4 nights in a row before they'll start kind of emerging. So yeah, we knew they'd come out in spring, but which night, you know, which particular, you know, window were we going for? And then when you realize that, yeah, you have to fence off an area that you're filming in and you have to get your film crew in and your camera set up and all that sort of stuff on night number one, and the cicadas don't turn up. But then on night number two, and the cicadas don't turn up. So they're predictable, but they're not that predictable.
Does your permitting team hate you? Does the people dealing permits?
I can't speak for them, but probably yes.
Okay, or they appreciate a challenge, I would hope. So speaking of like cicadas and just various species, because you know, for me at least, I'm a creepy crawly grossed out person. What is the I don't know what else to call it aside from like the casting process look like in terms of storytelling, right? Because there are billions of combinations of interwoven species. How do you decide who to feature?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So yes, all species are, as you say, interwoven. No species can exist in isolation. So we could have picked any living creature on the planet. But then which are those connections that are A, visible, or if not visible, then B, mind-blowing? You know, those are the things that we were kind of going for. And so our research team were speaking to field biologists and meteorologists and oceanographers and around the world to try and work out what their news stories are, what their current kind of research is. But then looking at ways of how we can link these into our bigger narrative. So we've all seen elephants. We've all seen elephants walking through kind of the dry season. But actually, we wanted to feature elephants because they engineer that particular post-flood landscape in a way that encourages bushfires. And then the bushfires do the thing that we tell the story that we want to tell, which is about the phosphorus that blows across the Atlantic and lands in the Amazon. So we were looking for cool animals, cute animals, amazing animals that do, you know, cool behavior we haven't seen before sometimes, behavior that we've seen lots in other times, but all has a wow moment off the back of it. And that means, oh wow, I never knew that. So, you know, it was a combination of what's the best cast that we can get and what are the coolest knock-on effects that they're having through this living network.
And which of them was the most diva-ish when it came to their riders? I kid. Yeah, I mean, when I learned that everyone was drinking hippo poop water, I went, wow, gross. So you got a wow out of me. What is, I'm going to assume, but I don't want to make an assumption, so I'm going to ask a question. Like, what are the rules and boundaries on interference, right? Like, is this a purely Darwinism production where, you know, you see survival of the fittest? Because, you know, watching a giant eagle go after a baby reindeer, I was like, oh no, you know, and that kind of protective instinct kicks in. Or are you all just observers? Like, is that the hard, fast rule?
I think it's different in different circumstances. Some of these sequences, we are set up to observe what is happening. You know, we're doing traditional wildlife filmmaking. We're there to observe what is happening in the natural world. So we're sending, you know, very experienced field crews, field teams out to observe the eagles preying on baby reindeers, to observe the lion hunting in the lion hunting the buffalo in episode two. In other sequences, we're actually, you know, the tortoise in the forest fire is a really good example here. You know, we can't send a film crew into the middle of a forest fire. We don't want to see a tortoise get roasted in the middle of a forest fire. So what we've done there is we've realized that, you know, the tortoise is a keystone species. It's been extensively studied to reveal that actually these tortoises help 200 plus species survive because they dig so many tunnels and these forest fires regularly come through. So we knew the story that we wanted to tell. So we storyboarded it and we essentially did a dramatic reconstruction there. And we kind of went in and there's a prescribed burn going on so we can film the fire. And then there's tortoises around so we can film the tortoises as well. But we're not going to be there when the two things are happening concurrently. So we're using all of the filmmaking storytelling tools that we've got in our arsenal to, you know, our visual effects or our set filming or our dramatic reconstruction or our long lens observational stuff. But when we are then casting and controlling what we're filming, then obviously we'll have, you know, there are very strict ethical and you know, health and safety and so on parameters that we abide by. But when we're filming what's happening in the natural world for those salmon swimming across the road, they're swimming across the road, and we're, you know, if we hope that cars aren't going to run them over, but if they do, then that's not, you know, it's not something we can do much about.
It's a Darwinism moment. It's actually a great segue into my next question. So what is the discussion like about when to employ and enhance with visual effects and how it sounds like these like dramatic, you know, reconstructions versus the purely shot footage?
So for me, it's about those take home moments that we've been talking about. And for, you know, if we are trying to tell the story about something that we can see, then we'll go out and film it. If we're trying to tell the story about something that we can't see, that's microscopic, or actually its knock-on effect is felt over a number of years or a number of millennia or you know, the trees moving north, we're not going to sit and wait with a camera to watch the trees moving north over 50 years. We're going to cut some, and we're going to show that, oh, look, this is what is happening, you know, and we're going to visualize that thing. So it's about, for me, it's about what can you see and what can't you see. And a lot of the time, the stuff that you can't see is where the magic is. You know, we talked about the nutrients kind of transferring on a microscopic level across the Amazon, for instance, or the mycelial networks beneath the trees. You know, yes, you want to see close up microscopic details of what they look like, so you understand what you're talking about. But that moment when you kind of come back, you do a big wide shot, and you say, "Do you know what? They're everywhere." Isn't that kind of magical and nice to then kind of go, "Ooh, the hairs stand up on the back of your neck" when you realize that they're going, "Oh yes, this whole place is connected." So we're telling big biological stories, and we're using all the visual tools that we can to help them land, really, to help tell those stories.
What is it like striking the balance of these, you know, you're telling big biological stories. I feel like survival is just like an inherently global thing that we as humans relate to, but you also are adding this sort of educational, you know, aspect of it, of the impact of humans in particular. How do you prevent it from becoming a lecture?
Yeah, that's a good question. This, you know, this series is on the Netflix platform, and it's an entertainment platform. And, you know, there's plenty of other things that people could choose to watch on Netflix that are straight entertainment. So, you know, we want people to be watching this show because they're enjoying it, not because they feel that they should, you know. So, and we've got, in terms of entertainment, we've got the best cast of any show on Netflix, you know, because we've got the elephants and we've got the killer whales and we've got the, you know, the periodical cicadas and the jaguars and the polar bears. You know, that is the best cast. And so there's, you know, there's something intrinsically attractive to our audience about watching these animals do what they do, that little baby chimpanzee, for instance. And then when you add that we've been able to, lucky enough to capture some really astonishing behavior and to tell some of these kind of wow stories, the hope is that is entertaining in a way that we want to watch that stuff. And actually, when we step out, we've been so immersed in these privileged moments in these animals' lives that when we kind of step out and say, and that's how this connects to a bigger picture, that's how this connects to everything else that's going on, that feels like a natural and entertaining segue. And it doesn't feel like we're going to, you know, this is a biology lesson that we're going to be giving you here. But that's, you know, that's the hope. And that's how we've tried to put the show together.
Yeah, I felt it. I just, there were the moments where, you know, I'm a crunchy green person myself, and I was just like, yeah, amp this up. But then you have to acknowledge that, as you said, it's an entertainment platform, right? And so trying to bring people into the storytelling, you know, I assume is your strongest tool here. But you mentioned your cast. You did not mention the most important human in it, Kate Blanchett.
Yeah.
I'm going to go a little tangential here with this question, though. Obviously, global audience, right? Narrated in English. I'm always curious, what is the accent discussion like? Because there are a few words she said, I was like, what did she just say there? But I realized that, like, that is because I'm used to hearing American accents, like methane and harem instead of harem, right? So I know it's a very, like, odd, specific question, but, you know, you were casting this voice of your piece. Like, do you give Cate Blanchett line reads, or is it just like, ma'am, say whatever you want?
So, a bit of both. I mean, the thing with Cate is that we always knew that we wanted a female voice, a female narrator for this show, because we're talking about Mother Nature and we're talking about, you know, the collaborative and nurturing aspects of the natural world. I think in the back of our minds, we had Galadriel, the Galvan princess, kind of walking around. So that voice was kind of echoing around the woods, and some of our visual effects looked very magical. And so, you know, that seemed to be a very natural fit. So, you know, Cate's voice was in our heads as we were making this stuff. But then it also turns out that she is, you know, very ecologically minded, and she's kind of, she's got a podcast on, you know, hope in the face of climate anxiety, and in the face of, you know, kind of, she's also a beekeeper. She's, you know, she's very tapped into, as anyone who keeps bees would be, the seasonality and the interdependence of species, plants and animals and species and so on and so forth. So she can speak with authority about a lot of the things that we were talking about. So there was a real kind of natural fit there. And then add to the fact that she's one, you know, she's an amazing storyteller, and that her voice just, you know, kind of elevates these stories that we're trying to tell. It felt like a really organic, natural fit. And, you know, she, as I say, she elevates the stories in a way that, you know, really puts them up there, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very funny for me to be like, what type of gas is she talking about? Oh, for me, methane, but for her, methane, who knows? Tomato, tomato, greenhouse gases are terrible. What place is on your travel list as a byproduct of having made the series, and what place are you no longer ever considering stepping foot into?
Yeah, interesting. We made the show during the travel restrictions. You know, a lot of the film during the travel. So actually, we didn't travel as much as we might have done in earlier times, and we tapped into a lot because of that. We tapped into a lot of in-country talent, a lot of in-country field teams, a lot of local camera operators, and a lot of you know, field producers in different parts of the world, which was a real revelation to me, that actually we don't have to fly as much kit and as many people all the way halfway around the world to film some of this stuff. That, you know what, there are people in lots of places around the world who are more than capable of capturing this stuff for us, and in some ways have better insights and better, you know, the ability to work locally. So that was a real revelation to me from a genre that traditionally travels to a lot of places with a lot of kit, that there isn't, you know, that there's not, there is potentially a different way of doing things. And it worked really well for this particular project because the form kind of matched the function that we were, you know, that we're talking about a global network where everything's dependent on everything else, and the active, and actually that's how we started to operate, that we had a central hub. You know, the South American guys were capturing the South American stuff, and the Australian guys were capturing the Australian stuff. So it seemed to work quite well. So I know that's not really an answer to your question, but it's a slight kind of reframe that we might not have to travel as much as we once did.
But I mean you personally, just as an individual.
I sat here in Bristol throughout the entire production, so it's...
if you had to pick one place, you're like, you know what, I think I may need to go oversee the next shoot in fill in the blank.
Yeah, where would I like to go from the list that we saw? Somewhere cold and snowy. I like the cold and snow.
So. Okay.
Reindeer land.
There you go. Just watch out for the eagle, scary hawk things. As a producer, what was the most absurd line item in your budget that you are allowed to share publicly?
I think we had a vehicle, a filming vehicle that got stuck on a seasonal island in the flooded, in that area of Argentina where we were filming the Jaguars, that the wet season had kind of come, and we'd managed to get this vehicle onto this bit of land that wasn't an island, and then became an island. And it sat there for quite a long time before we could get it off. So the higher costs on that one were probably larger than they should have
You know,
been.
it happens. It's Mother Nature does what she wants with our budgets. That is my time. Thank you so much. Congrats on the series. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Nice to chat to you, Dana.
A huge thank you to Ben. All four episodes of Our Living World are streaming now on Netflix. And if you like this episode, we would love it if you could leave us a 5-star rating, a review, or even consider subscribing.